You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the continent to bring you the truth about cannabis and marijuana law reform.
I smoke pot and I like it a lot.
The Russ Melville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation. Now, here's your host, Radical Russ Melville.
Good day, tokers and tokettes, and welcome to the show. It is Monday, June 23rd, 2014, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. Thank you so much for joining us. We're so glad you could be here. We've got a wonderful show today and for the rest of the week, but before we get to the show, let me make some quick announcements for our upcoming schedule. We are traveling down to the High Times Cannabis Cup in Santa Rosa, California this weekend. So this Friday, there will be no live Russ Melville show this Friday because we will be on the road. I'm sorry. Yes, I know. But we have to travel on the road down to Santa Rosa. We're actually going to be stopping in Medford on the way to visit friends of mine, the Duckworths, who will be standing trial for their operation of medical marijuana access point in southern Oregon. So we're going to spend some time with them while they're still free and hoping that they will remain free. But then it's on our way to the Santa Rosa Cannabis Cup, where Herb Thrasher and Left Wing Larry will be joining me at the 420 radio booth. I will also be presenting on the results of legalization. That presentation will take place at 4:30 on Saturday. We'll have the recording for you when we return on 420 radio. And by the way, speaking of that, next week is the 4th of July week. And if you've been following my show for the past couple of years, you know that that's one of our vacation weeks that we take. So not only is there no new show this Friday, there's no new shows all next week. It will be 4th of July week. However, I will run the video from the High Times Cannabis Cup. So there will be new stuff on the during the 3 o'clock hour. It just won't be a live show, so stay tuned for that. And speaking of our live show, let's go out to our news offices out in Colorado, where Priscilla Sybin is hanging out. How you doing, Priscilla?
How are you?
Doing fantastic. So you got 4 days for this week, and then you get a whole week off. And then tonight you're making your first official appearance as a 420 radio news director at a wonderful party.
Yes, I am. I'm really, really excited about that. I've got my outfit planned out. I'm going to represent.
All right. Looking forward to that. And, of course, looking forward to your news coming up in the next segment, where we have headlines coming out of Oregon and Washington, North Dakota and North Carolina. So stay tuned for that coming up right after this first break. Also on the show today, we'll take some time to go behind the headlines. We're going to take a look at a research opportunity that's happening. I don't know if it's opportunity is the right word. Research project that's happening up in Washington State. It's also been done elsewhere throughout the country, where drivers are surveyed on their drug and alcohol use and paid for that information while they're on the road. We'll talk about that and whether or not it's a good idea to participate in that survey. At half past, since it's Monday, we'll be visiting with Dr. Mitch Earlywine, the chairman of the Normal Board of Directors and the author of many, many marijuana-related books. He'll answer your live questions in our cannabis Q&A. You can dial in to 971-533-7111, or you can get your questions in through our chat room. And then at the end of the show, we'll have time for a radical rant. There's a great article in the Washington Post about policing pot for profit in rural West Virginia. We'll take a look at that and why cops are so in love with the war on pot users, why it profits them so much. All of that coming up in hour one, and then in hour two, we'll go into Toker Talk Radio, where you are the voice of the marijuana nation. You can call in open mic 971-533-7111, and we'll cover more news of the day. Speaking of the news, 420 Radio Headline News is next with Priscilla Sybin. Stay tuned.
Nation.
420 Radio, your ticket to Seattle Hemp Fest. The Marijuana Business Association, or MJBA, are proud sponsors of the Russ Belville Show. It is the mission of the MJBA to establish integrity and legitimacy, create common market standards, provide market intelligence, and develop best ethical business practices for participants in the emerging legal marijuana industry, including commercial hemp, medical marijuana, and recreational marijuana for adults. Learn more about the Marijuana Business Association and visit MJBA.net to join today. That's MJBA.net. 420radio.org is proud to replay the Hot Box Podcast with Matt Lee and Ian Baker from Kalispell, Montana. The Hot Box is a weekly talk show focused on the failed war on drugs, mainly cannabis, dissecting the latest mainstream marijuana news, medical cannabis legislation, and everything else weed-related, from growing to smoking and everything in between. Catch the replays Thursday at 11 Pacific on 420radio.org. The law offices of Omar Figueroa would like to remind you to stand up for your rights. If you are detained or arrested, treat law enforcement with respect and stand up for your rights by repeating, "I respectfully invoke all of my legal and constitutional rights. I do not consent to any search and seizure. I want to remain silent, and I want to speak with my attorney." Please contact the law offices of Omar Figueroa at 415-489-0420 or 707-829-0215 or on the web at omarfigueroa.com. It's time for the 420 Radio News, covering the latest headlines in consumer cannabis, medical marijuana, and industrial hemp. Transcripts of 420 Radio News are available daily on our website at 420radio.org. Now, here's Priscilla Simon.
Hi, folks. This is your 420 Radio News for Monday, June 23rd, 2014. The head of the campaign to place two initiatives on the November ballot to legalize marijuana in Oregon has thrown in the towel. Paul Stanford, head of the campaign for the restoration and regulation of hemp, made the announcement Friday on his television show, Cannabis Common Sense. Stanford said he'd raised 50,000 signatures for each measure, but would not have the 87,213 signatures needed for his Oregon Cannabis Tax Act, or OCTA, or the 116,284 signatures needed for his Help End Marijuana Prohibition, or HEMP, constitutional amendment by the July 3rd deadline. Stanford placed OCTA on the 2012 ballot and failed on election day with just 46.5% of the vote. Big national funders would not back Stanford then, and they preferred New Approach Oregon's campaign this time around. "I liked our initiatives better," Stanford said in his video. Quote, "but the big multimillionaire funders didn't."
And that begs the question, if they didn't, why did you move forward with all the time and effort to place redundant initiatives on the ballot? I just don't understand the logic behind this. After failing in 2012, after realizing, hey, even though I did have the money to put this on the ballot afterwards, I didn't have any money to do any campaigning with it, and it failed. Why then move forward 2 years later and try to do the exact same thing, but twice as hard by doing it with two amendments? And gee, realizing now, 10 days before the July 3rd deadline, that it didn't have a shot in hell, when people had been saying that earlier, way earlier, even when it was first committed. I just don't understand the logic that says, hey, look, there's going to be big multimillionaire funders going with New Approach Oregon, and they're going to legalize 8 ounces. But gosh, that's not good enough. Let's take all of our effort. Let's take all our money. Let's take all our volunteers and work on something else that won't get big signature funders, that won't get any big national support. And if it did make the ballot, you'd have to assume that the New Approach would also have made the ballot. And given voters two shots at voting at it, do you think more people would have chosen 8 ounces or more would have chosen 24? The only logic going into this would have been, we can get on the ballot and we can win, and the other one that's got the multimillionaire funders either won't make the ballot, or if it does make it, we'll beat it. That would be the only logic that would dictate moving forward with an independent grassroots ballot initiative. when you had one that's being run by the pros that had big money coming in, and this was well known way ahead of time. This is just, of those 50,000 signatures, I can't think of how many of them, how many thousands of them might have gone to the other initiative and given it even more of a cushion to make the ballot. How many more of those volunteers would have out there been canvassing people? How many fewer Oregonians would have been confused by the prospect of now, which one is this? Which legalization of this? How many spoiled signatures made it to the new approach ballot because of people not recognizing, oh, which one did I sign? I must have signed the other one. Maybe I should sign this one, and accidentally signing the same one twice. There was never any good reason to move forward with OCTA or hemp in the face of New Approach Oregon and professionals coming in to run a campaign. And I just hope so greatly that this one finally passes and we can put Paul Stanford's attempt at legalizing long in the past where they belong.
The first recreational pot shops are set to open next week in Washington State, but the few shops that open will be struggling to meet consumer demand. While 334 pot shops can be licensed statewide, only about a dozen will be ready to open in the first week of July. The Washington State Liquor Control Board must inspect the shops, and their limited staff will delay the rollout of many of the licensed retail facilities. Those that do open may face a supply crunch. Only 61 of the 2,554 applications for grower licenses have been approved by the board, and most of those licenses were approved recently enough that they won't have any legal marijuana to sell in the stores next week. Some stores are admitting that they will not have any product until August, and others are bidding up the price of what little marijuana will be available.
Yeah, this is going to be the difficulty rolling out Washington State's legalization. In fact, Dave Rines from the Marijuana Business Association was quoted in one of these stories about how they're setting this up for the first time. This is all brand new. Nobody has set up a retail recreational marijuana system from scratch ever before. Colorado's got the advantage of having just kind of attaching it to the existing medical system, right? So they already knew about, you know, brick and mortar and how it's supposed to be inspected and how do we license the bud tenders and how does it get taxed. All that stuff's already been worked out in Colorado. In Washington State, aside from the wink, wink, nudge, nudge dispensaries that are out there, there has never been retail marijuana in Washington State. So trying this from the ground up, they're bound to make a whole bunch of mistakes. And we're going to see the results of some of those mistakes. The first of one being not getting the growers licensed well in advance of the retail shops opening. When these few retail shops open, I think there's going to be two in Spokane that are going to open, maybe a few in Seattle, maybe a couple in Clark County. When these few shops open and the first few customers come in and they end up having to buy weed that's way overpriced just from the scarcity of the legal growers, and then way overtaxed on top of that, and those first few receipts start hitting the news media, oh, Washington State started selling weed, here's a guy with his receipt, and people around the country see $60 or $80 or $100 for an eighth, they're going to say, oh my God, I don't want legalization, look how expensive it makes the weed. Now, of course, those prices will come down once more of the growers get online, once more of the pot shops open up, but the first impression of Washington's legalized weed is going to be price is out of control, and we got to make sure that people understand in the few weeks and few months that will follow after that, that the prices are going to go down, and they're really going to go down once Oregon passes our legalization and forces Washington to have to reevaluate those really high taxes.
Right on. A North Dakota hemp activist was stopped at the Canadian border, and his 350 pounds of hemp seeds were seized by customs. Tom McLean has appealed to his congressman to intervene in the situation, pointing out that the latest federal farm bill grants allow states to proceed with industrial hemp research and development. North Dakota is one of the 15 U.S. states with laws allowing the production of industrial hemp. A spokesperson for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement said, quote, the shipment is currently undergoing scientific evaluation, as hemp seeds can look much like marijuana seeds, end quote. This seizure of non-psychoactive hemp seeds is the second such case we've reported on. The first required the state of Kentucky to sue the federal government for the return of hemp seeds imported from Italy. Despite the Farm Bill's hemp amendment, those wishing to import hemp seeds must still get permission from the DEA, a process that is hindering further development in the industry.
Yeah, you know, I've always said it's just silly that the Drug Enforcement Administration bans the production of a non-drug crop. I guess it's getting held up at customs. You know, well, we can't. You got 7 bags of 350 pounds of seeds here, and well, they might be legit hemp, legit marijuana seeds. They might not be hemp seeds. They might be marijuana seeds. So we got to test them. Really? Are they going to test all 350 pounds? Are they going to take a sample from each bag to test it? I mean, really, are they going to test the whole damn thing? Because if the guy was trying to import, you know, legit marijuana seeds, you know, psychoactive seeds, you could hide some of that in one of the bags, couldn't you? I mean, this is how silly marijuana prohibition gets. It gets to the point where you can't even grow a non-drug crop because we're trying so hard to stop its drug cousin. This is why we need to legalize marijuana, euphoric marijuana, THC marijuana for all adults, for all purposes, even for home grow, so we can stop this silly worrying about whether a seed is going to produce hemp or whether it's going to produce marijuana.
The North Carolina Senate is expected this week to debate the Hope for Haley and Friends bill that would make the Tar Heel state the 12th to pass CBD-only medical marijuana legislation. Last Thursday, the bill was rushed to committees after fears it would be placed on hold until the next session, passing the full House on a 111-2 vote. The bill would only allow use of CBD oil that is less than 0.3% THC and would be restricted to children with epilepsy who do not respond to any other treatment. The bill would also allow 3 university research hospitals, Duke, UNC Chapel Hill, and Wake Forest, to participate in clinical trials of CBD.
Well, I've already kind of gone off on these CBD-only bills, and you know, North Carolina's is especially silly in that it mandates 10% CBD to 0.3% THC. That's a ratio of 34 to 1. That's damn hard to find, even in Colorado. But the reason why they've got this 0.3% THC limit actually kind of references back to our previous story on industrial hemp. Industrial hemp is defined as any sort of hemp plant or hemp seed that contains less than 0.3% THC. The reason the industry settled on that is that's the little amount that you would need. Anything more than that, I should say, could trigger a positive on a drug test. So that's why they're considering it at 0.3%, even though you could have as high as 1 or even 2% THC in these oils and not really get anyone high. It's not about getting anyone high, it's about maintaining the drug testing industry's ability to get those people with more than the 0.3% THC in the substances they're ingesting.
A business-to-business magazine publisher has learned that even in a state where cannabis is legal, the mere word marijuana can threaten your bank account. Greg James publishes Marijuana Venture and learned that Wells Fargo Bank would not take any deposits from the magazine's publishing company. Marijuana Venture is no dope magazine, explains James, who says, quote, we are simply running stories on how to navigate the industry and promoting best-of-breed business practices, end quote. A spokesperson for Wells Fargo explained that the federally regulated bank has, quote, a long-standing policy of not banking marijuana-related businesses whose activities violate federal law, end quote. But James's magazine doesn't violate any federal laws, as it only reports on marijuana businesses and doesn't promote marijuana use or advertise marijuana sales.
Yeah, this is where we start to get into those, civil rights that were denied just because it's marijuana we're talking about here. This is in Washington State, and the guy has a business account with the Puget Sound Bank, but he was running his checks through another Wells Fargo branch for the distribution. And Wells Fargo is the one that said, no, we can't take this. But again, they're not violating federal law in any way. They don't advertise marijuana. They don't advertise marijuana for sale. They don't promote the use of marijuana in any way. This is a business-to-business magazine. This is like where to buy resealable containers, and here's software for sale for tracking seeds, and here's a place to buy security cameras for your dispensary, right? None of this stuff's illegal that we're talking about, but because it's got the word marijuana in it, all those white-collar suit and tie guys at the bank freak out and think that they're going to be sued or attacked, which is really surprising to me that the bankers can destroy the economy without even a single consideration. But you throw the word marijuana in there, oh, they all freak out. Hey, folks, it's 420 in Denver, Colorado, America's cannabis capital, and our own Priscilla Seibin must attend to a special 420 safety meeting. I hope you do, too. Priscilla, thanks for the news. We'll see you tomorrow.
Okay, bye.
When we come back, we go behind the headlines, taking a look at impaired driving surveys in Washington State. Stay tuned. 420 Radio, your ticket to the High Times Cannabis Cups. Adam Hand of Handmade Apparel produces quality custom designs for t-shirts, hats, and other apparel. Handmade Apparel is the official design shop for 420 Radio, among many clients who rely on Adam Hand for everything from short-run custom projects to full-run clothing lines. Visit handmadeapparel.biz to browse the selection of handmade gear or to get a personal quote for your own designs. Handmade Apparel, a proud supporter of 420.
Oliver had a brainstem injury. As a result of that, he has a lot of complex medical conditions, including refractory seizures.
Medical marijuana is helping so many children, just like Oliver.
Why can we not get access to that medicine to give my son the same hope and the same chance for life? Senator Skelos, please don't make us wait another year. Allow a vote on the Compassionate Care Act.
Growing plants indoors can be a rewarding hobby, but electricity bills can go through the roof. Then you have to cool down all those big hot lights. It can drive a grower insane. With Lush LED lighting, you can solve many of these issues and double your rewards. Matt and his scientists have developed the perfect light for flowering plants with far less cost and heat. And the results? Very effective. Check out LushLEDLighting.com right now and tell them Radical Russ sent you. Welcome back, everybody. 22 and a half after the hour. Time for us to go behind the headlines. We're Northwest Cable News and KING, King 5 News, up in Seattle, Washington, are reporting on a survey. The story is researchers pay drivers to answer pot survey. But it's a little more than that. Jonna Van Dyke is a program manager for the Washington Traffic Safety Commission, and they are bringing in crews from the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation. This is a group based in Washington, D.C., and they'll be conducting tests in six counties in Washington State. They have previously tested in Spokane, Yakima, King, and Snohomish counties. This weekend, they're in Whatcom and Kitsap counties. And what they're doing here is they're setting up signs at busy intersections and asking drivers to voluntarily participate in a survey about their use of substances and their driving habits. Crew members ask drivers questions about drug and alcohol use, and if drivers agree, administer a breathalyzer test as well as a blood test. Drivers can earn $60 if they complete the survey. So here's part of my problem with this kind of surveying. Number one is, what happens if I take that breathalyzer or that blood test and it shows that I'm impaired? They're not going to let me just go drive away, are they? Right? So they're setting up impaired drivers won't be arrested, they say. Crews will either ask someone else in the car to drive if they're sober or give the driver a free cab ride home. Okay, so now I've driven my car away from my home and I've done this survey for $60, and I come up at 6 nanograms per milliliter on the blood test, so I'm above the limit in Washington State. And so, yay, I get a free cab ride home. What if I was on my way to go do something? And how am I supposed to go get my car back? So I get the cab ride home, and now I'm going to have to arrange for rides or whatever else to go back and get my car. And do you think maybe after my car's been parked there for a while, cops have been told, hey, there's one of those guys that failed the pot test. Watch for that car. I can see that happening so easily. I don't think I would involve myself in that survey in any other way, in any way. The other problem that I've got here is that paying people to take a survey, in my mind, selects a poorer, more desperate sample of people to survey, right? Like, if you're the guy in the BMW and you're making, you know, $400 or $500 an hour as a consultant or a lawyer, as a hedge fund manager, hedge fund manager making only $400 an hour. I'm sorry. Didn't mean to insult y'all, but you know what I mean? If you're one of these rich guys in your Lexus and your BMW and your Jaguar, what's the chance that $60 is going to entice you to want to pull over and, you know, take a survey? But if you're the poor driver, if you're the person working two jobs, if you're the single mom, if you're the unemployed guy, if you're the immigrant, whatever it might be, that $60 is going to be more of an incentive for you to want to take the survey. So what kind of information do we get off of the most desperate drivers out there, right? If someone is so poor that $60 is going to entice them to want to take the chance on the impaired driving survey, perhaps they're also so poor as to be the kind of person who drives because they have to get to work and have no other choice to get to work and may choose to drive in situations where they shouldn't have driven. Are we going to get a sample that is more representative of desperate poor people and the desperate choices they make? And how is that going to tell us anything accurately about what's going on the roads? We're only going to know about the people who are poor enough and desperate enough for whom $60 is going to be an enticement, and those who aren't busy enough to actually take the time to take the survey. So it's not going to tell us anything about those Lexuses and Jaguars and Mercedes that are running around on the road. It's not going to tell us anything about the truck drivers or the people that are driving for work where they probably can't take the time to stop. It's going to be a very skewed sample of people with a lot of time on their hands and not a whole lot of money. And I don't think it's going to tell us very much about what we want to know with respect to impaired driving. Now, they're saying the need for this. Washington State is saying there's a need for this thanks to legalization of marijuana. They want to have some idea of what the roadways are like. And Van Dyke from PIRE, was she from PIRE? You know, from Washington Traffic Safety Commission, says, quote, "There is a concern not only at the state level, but at the national level about what this is going to do to our driving population. Washington is on the forefront of a really huge change." And the survey ended Sunday night, by the way, so it's not happening anymore. This was last weekend that we're talking about. But I'm always just amazed at this idea that now that we've legalized marijuana, somehow things are going to radically change. As if the people who would drive on pot haven't already been doing so for years. And the people who haven't been driving on pot, or the people who haven't been smoking pot because it's illegal, are the kind of people who follow laws. So why would they then violate the laws against smoking and driving? I don't think much is going to change at all with respect to traffic, accidents, driving, and marijuana, because marijuana's been here for decades.
You're tuned into the Russ Belville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation.
420 Radio, turning red states and blue states green. I'm Radical Russ Belville, and I want to thank you for listening to 420 Radio. We couldn't survive without you and our sponsors, and I'd like you to check out one of our prime sponsors, the National Cannabis Coalition. I've been working with NCC since June of 2012, and I'm proud to be part of the team they have assembled. National Cannabis Coalition is building the partnerships with reformers, lawmakers, and industry we need to be successful. Visit the National Cannabis Coalition website at nationalcannabiscoalition.com or the easier-to-remember ncc420.com. That's where you'll get the exclusive first look at my radical rants, as well as informative articles from the nation's top cannabis pundits. Visit ncc420.com today, and if you have your phone handy, text Russ to 420-420 to support NCC and 420 Radio. It's a free text message that helps us help you end adult marijuana prohibition. Learn more at ncc420.com, and thanks for supporting independent marijuana legalization public radio. 420radio.org is proud to replay Jorge Cervantes TV from Barcelona, Spain. Jorge Cervantes, the author of the best-selling books in marijuana horticulture, has dropped the disguises and brings you pro indoor and outdoor grow tips from the European masters. Catch the replays Thursday at 1 Pacific on 420radio.org. You know Herb Thrasher from the Herb Thrasher Flower Hour. Now get ready for Herb Age Designs for the proud cannabis consumer. Herb Age Designs, lifestyle gear for the 420 friendly. Herb Age Designs, we've got frisbee golf discs and durable hemp gear. Herb Age Designs, we've got shot glasses, drinking glasses, coffee mugs, and beer cozies. Check us out on Facebook and online at herbagedesigns.com. And follow Herb Age and Herb Thrasher on Twitter.
It's time for the Russ Belville Show's Cannabis Q&A with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Dr. Earlywine is a professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and a leading author and researcher on cannabinoids and health, who pens the Ask Dr. Mitch column for High Times magazine. Get your questions ready in our live chat or call in to 971-533-7111 now.
Welcome back, everybody. 31 after the hour, and we've got Dr. Mitch on the line from SUNY Albany. How you doing, Dr. Mitch?
Oh, delightful. How about you?
I'm doing fantastic, and I'm so glad summertime is finally here. The festival season is in full swing. Really looking forward to getting out on the road. This is our Cannabis Q&A with Dr. Mitch, and we want to remind everyone you've got the chance to ask your questions on cannabis science, culture, history, and health. Just dial that number right there, 971-533-7111, or you can get into our chat room and ask us that way. We'll take all your questions right now live on 420 Radio. We always open up with giving Dr. Mitch the chance to tell us what's the first word in cannabis science. What's latest, doctor?
Oh, the FDA put out its new guidelines for marijuana research with human subjects, along with some really patronizing warnings for those who are looking for treatment. There's a 7-step process that requires interactions with 3 different federal agencies. It's just the most insane conglomerate of Byzantine nuttiness I've seen in a long time.
Is this their reaction to those recent stories? DPA came out with that thing, you know, 4 decades of obstructing research into marijuana. Is this their reaction to it?
And the irony is it's not improved. It's just everything laid out like it's been for decades. When you look at the fact that you have to interact with 3 different federal agencies, when literally the guy down the hall might be doing stuff on cocaine and doesn't have to go through the same nonsense, it's kind of spooky.
So there's people out there researching on other scheduled drugs, even Schedule 1 drugs. Do they have better access to them than marijuana, like, you know, say acid, PCP, Ibogaine, anything like that?
Well, the funny thing is Ibogaine, no, but in part because there's just more available. So the fact that there's only so much marijuana for research is pretty telling. And then the whole notion of medical use having to walk through NIDA seems pretty silly, because NIDA is really supposed to be about drug problems and drug abuse. So it's just completely nutty in all domains.
So NIDA is still sticking to their line that, we fund plenty of therapeutic studies. And it turns out like half of what they consider therapeutic studies are things like using Sesamet to combat marijuana addiction.
Exactly. Nabilone in dogs, just insane stuff. Looking for Marinol and anti-nausea stuff when, you know, we already know this. I mean, it's just insane. And then we get folks who are then saying, you know, we need more research on this, and you see why it's not done. And there are just some domains. I mean, the idea that we need more research on marijuana and appetite, I mean, really? You know, the idea that marijuana fights nausea, we don't need more data on that. Let's be candid here. And so it's insane and really kind of sad.
Yeah. All right. Well, there's a op-ed up on the New York Times today not today. It's from the 20th. So last, Friday? Yeah. Op-ed that was on Friday from T.M. Luhrmann, who is listed as a professor of anthropology at Stanford. Had a couple things in this op-ed I wanted to run by because I thought they were quite interesting. One is he makes this word, you know, candy's dandy, but pot's scary. And he says, as marijuana laws ease, the risks grow, which always surprises me because it's not as if legalizing invents marijuana. I don't think it gets any more risky now that it's legal. In fact, it's less risky because you can't be arrested. But anyway, his opening point is the marijuana and schizophrenia. And he refers back to a 1987 study that was published in The Lancet about the 45,000 Swedish military conscripts. The ones who used cannabis more than 50 times were six times as likely 15 years later to be diagnosed with schizophrenia. They also did a 2007 meta study in The Lancet showing a 50 to 200% increased risk among the heaviest users for the reality disconnect of schizophrenia. We've talked about schizophrenia and marijuana before, but can you speak to those two studies specifically?
It's interesting because that 87 study from The Lancet has the largest sample size, so everybody's made a big deal out of it. But the 45,000 Swedish military conscripts didn't all end up psychotic. And in fact, it's just a questionnaire trying to assess some of their psychotic-like symptoms. It's not really full-blown schizophrenia. And then we don't really have a decent measure of what kind of psychotic symptoms they had before. So we don't really know, is this a self-medication issue, or is this actually cannabis associated with subsequent development? We just don't have it. The fact that it's a 15-year follow-up is really great. The notion that, hey, it's six times as likely, that's great too. But it's not a clean marijuana is a cause of psychosis. That meta-analysis was interesting and actually did suggest that there was some links between heavy cannabis use and schizotypy, that sort of schizophrenia-like condition that we talked about before. But again, the way that is assessed can sometimes be biased against cannabis users or any subgroup that has sort of their own jargon, their own argot, their own sort of slang. So I think if you studied rappers or you know, folks who are in a sport that has a lot of its own language, some of the items that ask you about making up words or using words in novel ways end up making people look more psychotic than they actually are. And, of course, they didn't do any real attempt to control for that across these studies. So, yeah, if you got a schizophrenic identical twin, don't smoke pot. I completely understand. And in truth, if one of your parents is severely psychotic, this probably isn't the plant for you. But the bottom line here is how many people should go to jail because of that?
Right. That's always the bottom line to me, too, is if they, even if everything they said was true about cannabis, that doesn't mean we should arrest people for it, does it? That doesn't mean we should keep it illegal so criminals control the market. That doesn't seem like much of a defense on their side. There was another interesting aspect to this op-ed that referred to a book called Drunken Comportment from 1969, written by a couple of anthropologists, who point out that the reaction to alcohol seems to be anthropologically or culturally defined, where like Americans drank, fought, and were more promiscuous. But that's because Americans think that alcohol is disinhibiting. They looked at other cultures that drank plenty of strong alcohol and found silent, thick-lipped drunks or talkative but not violent drunks. And they found that anthropology, I mean, the culture around drinking had a lot to do with how people responded to drinking. I think this actually makes an argument for us to have the type of cannabis lounges and smoking sessions, have that legal so people can learn those cultural cues. Had you heard about this before? And what do you think culture will do as far as affecting people's use of legal, now legal marijuana?
Craig McAndrew's work is really dear to my heart, so of course I've heard about this, and in fact, one of my first published studies used some data based on this in placebo administration with alcohol. So not only do folks who believe certain things about alcohol experience it with alcohol, they also experience it with placebo, which can be actually kind of funny, Russ, you can imagine. I love the idea of, in fact, people's expectations about cannabis are very much related to their experience. So we all remember that old Animal House situation where the kid says, "Will I go psychotic?" And the teacher says, "It's a distinct possibility," right? Once you set up that expectation, oh, am I going to get paranoid? Am I going to get paranoid? Am I going to get paranoid? Sure enough, you get paranoid. And I think modeling friendly, delighted interactions with cannabis, especially in the kind of environments you're talking about, would be definitely the way to go. I also know from some of Craig Reinerman's data, they model moderate use. They don't, you know, try to clear the bong like some kind of athlete. You end up showing and modeling that a little bit is enough, and that once you're there, you're there, and there's no need to waste pot by getting too high.
Is that then possibly an argument for the opposition? I mean, some of the things the opposition says sometimes, you know, when we'll point out Portugal or the Netherlands, they'll say, oh, yes, but that's a different culture. It's a different culture than America. Is there any credence to that idea that maybe Portuguese and Dutch can handle it, but Americans, our culture, wouldn't be able to handle it as well?
I'm afraid that's often masked racism, Russ.
Yeah.
When they say there's a different culture, they mean there's no blacks or Latinos. I mean, it's just so sad that that's how it comes out. And, that ridiculous woman who says, Portugal's not a superpower. I mean, anything that we have in common with the Portuguese, hey, we're all people. And I know it's a delightful area over there. I love all of Europe. It's really wonderful. But bottom line is, physiologically, we're all very much the same. And so if it can work over there, it could certainly work over here.
You know, there's a discussion going on in our chat room right now about the synthetic cannabinoids and even whole plant extracts that are being manufactured by companies like GW Pharmaceuticals, Marinol, Sativex, Epidiolex. Can you give us any update on any trials or any timetables on when some of these newer GW Pharma drugs might become available in the United States?
GW is really doing a good job, to tell the truth, of essentially lobbying the appropriate people to make sure that they can get clearance. But right now, their data has been pretty much restricted. So they've got some nice stuff in MS patients with muscle spasm and nausea and sleep problems and things like that. But they really, you know, have to go through a lot of hoops. They often do some of the studies over in the UK rather than here. And I just don't see it happening anytime fast. However, when laws like New York just passed and that one in Minnesota, I think that they're really gearing up and kind of licking their chops about the idea that, hey, if extracts are going to be the only way you can administer, we're going to be at the front of the line, so to speak, for making the money off that.
Yeah, especially when these, like North Carolina's proposed bill is 10% or higher CBD by weight and 0.3% THC or lower by weight. That sounds to me like something only a very specialized pharmaceutical company could come up with any reliability.
I mean, I hate to say it, but there's some hemp out there that's more than 0.3 THC.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, that's almost impossible. I don't even know if that's going to be able to grow. So that means you're going to have to dilute the extract in these oddball ways. And it just gets more and more synthetic and more chemical. And it really kind of takes away from part of the glory of this, which was that it was essentially organic in nature and that kind of had a wholesome feel.
Yeah, Gothic Prophet has a follow-up. Once GW gets their approval, isn't there a limited period of exclusivity before competitors can offer up generic equivalents?
Yeah, depending on the nature of that patent, it might be 7 years. Again, depending on who their attorneys are, so to speak. But yeah, then suddenly the generics will come out, I would imagine, pretty fast and pretty furious. So all we can do is sit back and watch. But again, I like the, you know, the spray administration format, but it's certainly not as fast as inhaled vapor. It's a little faster than trying to eat the edibles. So it's kind of a nice happy medium, but it's still not ideal. And there's a subset of folks who find that spray inside the mouth a little irritating and would just, you know, markedly be more rapidly healed if they could use vaporized cannabis.
Now, the last couple of states to pass medical cannabis, Minnesota and now New York State, have gone and made it no smoking. You can't smoke it. And I know a lot of times the doctors on the other side will say, you know, smoking is not medicine. You don't smoke medicine. And we are talking about inhaling, you know, some things that are in smoke that aren't necessarily good for you. Is there a case for allowing the medical use of smoking, assuming that, you know, a person could have a vaporizer instead?
In truth, I feel like the argument for vaporized flower is completely wonderful. You'd still have whole plant products and all the advantages of that and all the possible strains. And because you're vaporizing, there's literally no potential for respiratory irritation. But in all honesty, folks who smoke cannabis and only cannabis do not show a ton of respiratory irritation. We were trying to find them for that vaporizer study I ran a few years ago, and they're not easy to find. And to just get, tightness in the chest and frequent coughing, we'd have to go through maybe 40 people to find somebody who'd actually have both those symptoms. So I'm understanding of the physician's position, but I think we're really drawing a wall around the law of safety, so to speak. So this would be super conservative if it was only vaporized. And in fact, when you talk to people who have, some kind of lung conditions, they're more than willing to vaporize. And as vaporizers have gotten more portable, more electronic, faster in their heating up, pretty soon they're going to be as good as putting a match to the pipe.
Yeah, it just seems to me one of the arguments that was made in New York State was the convenience of it. Well, for some patients, they couldn't afford a vaporizer. They're not as portable. They can't go anywhere. So the smoking sometimes is the best option for them. I always say it, banning the smoking seems to me a solution in search of a problem. Like you said, we haven't really seen a problem with lung function in those who smoke only cannabis.
Well, and what's sad is, if I'm reading the New York State law right, they really don't mean vaporized flower. They really mean it's got to be an extract. And we don't have as long a history of safety with the extracts. And that DABS paper that Mallory and I just published suggests that some people at least feel like they're developing tolerance a little more rapidly and getting, if they are withdrawal symptoms, they seem to be getting those a little more rapidly with a sort of DABS approach than they would if they had flower cannabis.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll keep our eye on that as more data becomes available. It's going to be a year or two before I think we have a whole lot of information on use of oil and DABS, but we will keep you apprised of it here on our cannabis science segment. Dr. Mitch, thanks for joining us again, and we will see you not next week because we're off next week, but in 2 weeks.
Looking forward to it.
All right. Thank you so much. When we come back, time for a radical rant. We're going to talk a little bit. Stick around.
You're tuned into the Russ Belville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation.
420 Radio. Tune in, turn on, get highly educated. When you are starting up a medical cannabis business, you want a fired up lawyer who understands the needs of cannabis consumers. The Law Office of Lauren Vasquez is your fired up lawyer for the cannabis industry. Visit her website, fireduplawyer.com, or call 1-855-MMJ-LAWS for more information. That's 855-665-5297 for Lauren Vasquez, your Fired Up Lawyer, or email fireduplawyer@gmail.com. In the interest of fair and balanced journalism, the Russ Belville Show presents the anti-drug public service announcement of the day.
My friend Nancy's been doing a lot of drugs. Now it's catching up with her. I can see it coming. But what can I do? If I, like, say anything, she'll think I'm not cool. And I don't want to lose a friend. I mean, it's her life. Right?
If you have a friend who's in trouble with drugs, don't just stand there. Do something.
This has been the anti-drug public service announcement of the day. To cure this sort of reefer madness, listen to the Russ Belville Show every weekday on 420radio.org. New Approach Oregon is a coalition of Oregon citizens who believe that treating marijuana use as a crime has failed, costing taxpayers millions in law enforcement resources. Our approach will regulate, tax, and legalize marijuana for adults in Oregon. We can move Oregon forward and create new revenue for critical services. Visit our website at newapproachoregon.com or our page on Facebook at New Approach Oregon. Thank you.
You can't handle it. handle the truth.
Entirely legitimate topic for debate.
You have offended my family.
Hey, this is great, man.
And you have offended a Shaolin temple.
One major responsibility is to encourage people to use less drugs.
I know nothing.
I support a change in law to end federal criminal penalties for possession of up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
We don't need no stinking budget.
Homosexuality.
Down the centuries, you have slurred the meaning of the words "we, the people."
Be warned, this is not your mother's marijuana.
You gotta ask yourself a question: do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
I want to ask you a bunch of questions. I want to have them answered immediately.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
Radical Rant.
Welcome back, everybody. 50 after the hour. I want to talk about this story that is on the Washington Post, written by Mark Fisher. Came out this Saturday. Even as marijuana gains ground, some tightly enforce laws. And it takes a look at the West Virginia Panhandle, just, I guess it would be west of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, if I know my geography correctly. And this in-depth look at how marijuana policing has skyrocketed in the northern panhandle of West Virginia, soared by more than 200% in the first decade of this century. The biggest arrest rate jump of any locality in America, right there in northern West Virginia. And they say it's ground zero for the drug war because it's 35 miles away from Pittsburgh, and it's kind of a hub there for trafficking throughout the Midwest. And Sergeant Brian Allen, a state trooper assigned to the Drug Enforcement Administration Task Force, says, quote, "Arresting them's easy. Marijuana is everywhere around here," end quote. But West Virginia and this northern area is quite different than the trend that's happening throughout the rest of the country. The number of pot smokers, people who admit to regular cannabis consumption, has jumped 20% between 2007 and 2010, according to the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. But even as smokers have gone up 20%, possession arrest numbers have gone down from 2007 to 2012 by 42%. So the national mood for arresting pot smokers seems to be diminishing, and not just in California and Colorado and Washington state, but we're seeing decriminalization pass in places like Missouri and Delaware and Connecticut. We are finding, you know, 19 states now that have decided that using punitive jail time and criminal records for personal possession of marijuana is not a wise use of taxpayer resources. There are exceptions. Virginia's Fairfax County doubled its arrests between 2000 and 2013. Now, the article takes a look at three main reasons for this disparity between the national mood for marijuana arrests versus the police's appetite to keep increasing them. And this is what they found in talking to numerous officers, the three main reasons. Number one, the gateway theory. That's right, the gateway theory that has been disproven since 1999, that every serious research study, researcher, university, scientist that takes a look at the gateway theory, the idea that using marijuana is going to lead you to using other drugs, they've all declared it to be bunk. It's just not true. There's nothing about marijuana that primes the brain to want harder drugs. That's always their argument. Yeah, once you get high on pot, then you're going to want to get high on other things. You won't get high on pot anymore, and then you're going to want meth and coke and all this. Which is kind of like saying, since you like cheeseburgers, that's going to prime your stomach to want to eat octopus. They don't have anything to do with each other. These people tend to think that high is high, that drug is drug, right? That some, for some reason, I as a pot smoker would eventually want to graduate to heroin. Because, gee, pot's not good enough, I want some heroin. They take into account nothing about the fact that drugs are different. They all have different effects, and people like different effects from drugs. They are different brands. They are different products. These are guys that can clearly and probably vehemently defend their choice of Budweiser over Coors Light or a Marlboro over a Camel. but would think that anybody who uses drugs would just use any of them. Smokers will be dedicated to one particular type of cigarette, despite the fact there are multiple brands of cigarettes out there, and chewing tobacco, and snuff, and pipes. And yet they'll be diehard, and literally die, as a Camel smoker or a Marlboro smoker. They'll be hooked on that one brand and never switch, even though the difference between them is negligible. Same for the beer drinker. Just because someone likes drinking Miller High Life doesn't mean that they're then going to graduate to drinking, you know, Bacardi 151 inexorably. The guy who likes to drink beer on the weekends, he's not going to shift from Miller Lite to Bacardi 151 any more than he's going to shift from Miller Lite to Coors Light. Again, a difference that's technically negligible. How is it they can understand people's desire for a particular type of beer or tobacco product, but they tend to think all drugs are the same and everyone will just graduate to a different and new and more potent drug? But that's what they believe. These cops, according to this story, say some police see marijuana as a pathway to addictive prescription pills, heroin, and cocaine. Cracking down on pot will cut the supply and use of those harder drugs, they say. Well, if that's the case, how come we're now in the grips of a heroin epidemic? You thinking the heroin epidemic is because more people are smoking pot? But you're cracking down harder and harder on people that smoke pot. How come it's not having any dent on the heroin? How come the heroin's going up? If you look at drug consumption throughout different types of drugs, it has no correlation whatsoever with whether marijuana use goes up or down. Drug use goes up and down for a variety of factors, not because people are using pot. And in fact, many people are moving away from the hard drugs through the use of pot. They quote one young man in the story who talked about kicking an opiate addiction and how he would smoke pot whenever the craving for opiates kicked in. That he was using it as an exit drug, not a gateway drug. Another reason why the cops still like to go after pot, according to this Washington Post story, up the drug ladder. Some police believe that marijuana possession arrests provide a unique opportunity to capture dealers whose sales of heroin and meth are ravaging many U.S. communities. And then they give an example here. The young person with just a couple buds says, I can't afford to go to jail and lose my job. He says, it's just grass. Johnny down the street's selling OxyContin. And you say, okay, well, can you buy some from Johnny for us? And there you go. You can catch what you can and move up the grapevine to catch what you really need to catch. There's your gateway. The young person you caught with the buds had no interest in going to the dealer and buying any OxyContin until you made that his choice over going to jail. You've actually used marijuana as a tool to recruit free volunteer snitches. That's why they don't want to lose the marijuana. Because they know trying to get the volunteers to go buy the OxyContin for them won't be as easy if they can't bust them for the weed. Like they said, everybody's got it. It's everywhere. So the only issue with marijuana is that it's a tool that you get to use to go after things that are really harmful. That sounds to me as if the marijuana itself isn't that harmful. It's just useful. It's utilitarian. And then, of course, the big one, federal funding. In the hurried drive to stimulate the nation's economy after the start of the Great Recession, the federal government pumped more than $4 billion into its main crime-fighting grant program, known as Burn Grants, and expanded other programs to bolster enforcement. Denise O'Donnell, who runs the Federal Bureau of Justice Assistance, which administers the Burn Grants, says her agency is examining whether the program, quote, is somehow incentivizing agencies to make more low-level arrests, end quote. Really, you think there, Denise? She says she's trying to correct the misperception by spreading the message that, quote, it's really important that these funds be used against high-level organizations and not in a way that's creating any disproportionate impact on people of color, end quote. Well, we know that it is. We know that it is creating a disproportionate impact on people of color, and we know that the cops are using it to target low-level arrests because they have to fill out these forms for these burn grants. And their federal funding in West Virginia jumped from $338,000 to $576,000. They destroyed 6 times as many plants in 2010 as they did in 2007. And the defense attorneys say, really, potheads are easy to find. They don't even try to deny it. They're growing it for themselves and maybe some friends. They're not a network of heroin or meth dealers. Most people that are getting their weed are getting it from people who deal weed only, and they do it as a side gig to supplement the fact they don't get paid a living wage at the job they work 40 or 50 or 60 hours a week at. All right, folks, we gotta go. For Priscilla Simon, I'm Radical Russ. Until next time, take care of each other, tokers.
This is the Russ Belville Show. The Russ Belville Show is blogging and podcasting daily at radicalruss.com. You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you try it, you